Thank you everyone for coming to the Pinwheel today on PTSD and recovery. The Pinwheel Education Series is a bi-monthly forum that brings together experts and the public to talk about mental health and mental wellness. And everything related to the Pinwheel series, including a recording of today's session, can be found at healthymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. We appreciate your feedback. So if you can, please fill out your feedback form. And if you signed up through Eventbrite, you would have also got a link to a feedback form online. So you can also do it that way, which is great. For those of you joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving BC children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to families and youth, as well as to people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. Please go to our website, keltymentalhealth.ca, for more information, resources, and for our contact info. Okay, like I noted before, but now there's a few more people in the room, we did have a bit of a programming change today. Unfortunately, one of our speakers, Corey Reed, his car broke down on the way here, so he's unable to join us. But luckily, we're able to have another great person be able to speak to their lived experience, and that person is Andrea Vukobrat, who I'm going to introduce now. Andrea is an institute and forced youth and residents working out of the Kelty Center and has lived experience with anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder. Her PTSD stems from childhood wartime experiences, and through the services and support she's accessed, she's learned to manage the effects it has had on her life. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you. So thank you everyone for being here today. I'm just going to speak generally about my own lived experience as well as the experiences of my family because my family came here in 1994 as refugees from the Balkans. And it was very much not something that was ever discussed. We never really received, we received so much support from Canada in terms of settling, but at the same time that mental health piece wasn't really there. And so as a child, I very much thought that there was something wrong with me because I remember being 5 years old and having my first panic attack. I started crying. To my mom, it seemed like out of the blue, but I'd had a thought process go on where it suddenly hit me like, oh my God, one day my parents are going to die, which is like, even at five, I was like, that's a weird thing for a child to think about. So I would have these things where it would snowball. I would start thinking about stuff like if we learned about earthquakes in school, I would start thinking about, oh my God, what if there's an earthquake and my family dies or something like that. And then that constant reassurance seeking, like, what if there's an earthquake? What if there's a fire? Is the door locked? Like, are my windows closed? And my parents just kind of thought, oh, okay, she's just an anxious kid. And it very much, like, it makes sense now when I look back on it, but it very much came from those first 3 years of my life spent with a lot of insecurity and lack of resources and lack of not family support, because I was with my mom the whole time and my sister, but a lack of mental health support once we were out of the situation. And for my parents, you know, they very much never really dealt with it or talked about it because they had to keep their heads down and build a life for us here. And you know, I remember them working 3 jobs at a time, each of them, and so it was very hard for them to see how it was affecting me because they were denying how it was affecting them as well. And in elementary school, I began to get stomach aches all the time, and I had no idea where they came from, and I had a very heightened startle response, so somebody touching me on the shoulder would make me jump a foot in the air. And those panic attacks, which I didn't know were panic attacks at the time, I just, you know, thought like, oh my God, I'm freaking out. And if we were stuck in an elevator, it wasn't, oh, we're stuck in an elevator, it's we're stuck in here forever and we're never going to leave. And then as I got older, because I never really connected the dots, I never anticipated that I would have additional needs. So as I got older, I started finding coping tools that helped me manage the anxiety, but these coping tools weren't necessarily the healthiest. So I started engaging in self-harm. I struggled with bulimia for a while, for about 6 years, and also substance use. When I turned 18, I really started using drugs and alcohol to cope with the anxiety. And it, like I said, I never connected the dots, but something that pushed me to get help was the emotional volatility that I was displaying. And it was very difficult to admit that it was affecting me so much, especially because it often came out as freaking out and being horrible to the people that were closest to me. So my mom, or a lot of the brunt of my anxiety. And one day, actually, I had a meltdown because I couldn't find something, and I was convinced that my mom had thrown it away. And it was, I think it was calcium supplements, and that just, like, set me off. And I actually kicked a hole in the wall. And this is like our brand new apartment that we just moved into, and I think I was about 18 at the time, and my mom was like, you know what, we can't keep living like this, and if you don't get help, you can't live here anymore. And I'm 25 now, so me and my mom have a good relationship, and I asked her the other day, I'm like, would you have actually kicked me out? She's like, no, and I was like, yeah. but just the way she said it to me, it was like she wasn't being upset with me. She was just like, you know what, this is not working anymore. And she put her own emotions aside for me to have that moment of clarity of, oh my God, no, it's not working. So I started seeing a counselor, and then from there I started seeing a psychologist. And with the psychologist, I remember talking about stuff, and I just kind of casually offhand mentioned that we came from the Balkans, and she was like, oh, so were you there when the war was going on? And I was like, yes, but you know, I don't remember any of it, so there's no way that could affect me. And she's like, well, you know, those first 3 years of your life are very important for brain development and for the creation of, you know, neural connections and stuff like that. And she said, it's very possible that could be at the root of your anxiety, and have you ever talked about it with your family? And I was like, oh my God, no, like nobody ever talks about it. Nobody in my culture really talked about it. It was just kind of offhand remarks. And she gave me the chance to educate myself better about my brain and to start understanding my brain better. And the more I understood my brain, the more forgiving I was with myself, because I think when you have anxiety, there's a lot of shame and guilt heaped on top of the anxious feelings themselves, so it's hard to get the support for the anxiety when you're already struggling with, oh my God, there's something wrong with me. And so with that, another key piece, along with the education around PTSD and what it meant for me, she really encouraged me to connect with my parents and with my sister, because they had their own experiences as well. And I'd say that was probably one of the most helpful things that I did. I remember sitting down with my dad, and another thing I struggled with was health anxiety. I was constantly worried there was something wrong with my body. And my dad took me out for coffee one day. I was having a really hard time leaving the house, and I was, you know, obsessed with thinking I had some kind of condition. And I told him, I'm so afraid of dying that I want to die. And I thought, you know, when it came out of my mouth, I was like, that makes no sense, and he's going to think I'm nuts. And I started crying right away. And he looked at me, and he's like, I know exactly how you feel. And I was like, what? Like, how do you know? And I was like, do you have health anxiety? And he's like, no. And he told me how during the war he had been so afraid of dying, of you know, meeting his bullet, that he almost started wishing he was dead. Because he's like, the uncertainty will wear away at you. Until you start feeling like, I can't take this anymore, it would just be better off to not. And I asked him, well, what got you through it? And he said, you know, just the thought of being reunited with you guys again got me through it. And he talked to me about how, like, you have to find those things that give you certainty in times of uncertainty. So those things like knowing that my parents loved me, and knowing that I had the support of my sister, and knowing that I had things that about me that I could feel proud of. It really helped me, because I think sometimes when you receive a diagnosis, it can start to feel like that's all you are, and you start to identify with it so much that you lose yourself. So just really becoming comfortable with the fact that happened to me, but it's not all that happened to me, and it's not going to define me. And I think a wonderful side effect that I've seen from this is that my family's a lot more open in talking about it. My sister's 6 years older than me, so she was 9 when we left, and she remembers everything, and for her it was it really pushed her to be a high achiever, but also never really talking about it. And then once we started talking about it more, I became more comfortable talking about it, and I started talking with my friends who had also come from the Balkans. And it's funny, because we'd flash back to things like school presentations where there was loud music and one of my friends started crying and had to be escorted out, or not being able to take it when there's fireworks outside. None of those things clicked for us when we were kids, because nobody told us that might happen. So I think just talking about it and learning more about it can be hugely helpful for people, because you do internalize that stigma. So yeah, that's me.
Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, Andrea won't be able to stay for questions at the end, but can definitely contact the Kelsey Center, maybe if you have questions for her later on about her story. But next, I do want to introduce our second speaker to make sure that we do have time for questions at the end. And I'm excited to introduce Victoria Hurst. Victoria is a clinical social work specialist in the teaching clinic here at BC Children's Hospital, where she teaches and consults in family therapy and trauma-informed practice. Prior to being at Children's Hospital, she spent 21 years at Family Services of Greater Vancouver, where she worked as a therapist and program manager of the Counseling, Trauma, and Victim Services programs. She has a private practice in Coquitlam. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story.
That was very powerful. So some of the areas I'm going to try to cover in a really short time is just talk a little bit about the difference between a typical response to trauma and then when it crosses that line and switches into PTSD. Briefly going to go through it, the diagnosis of PTSD, what it looks like in children, because it can be very different than what you might see in adults. Talk about what parents can do to support their children and then some best practices for additional treatment around PTSD. So generally, if there's a traumatic event, most people, children, adults, will experience a wide range of physical and emotional reactions. The mind and the body kind of go into shock, and it's really normal to feel afraid, scared, overwhelmed. Those are pretty typical reactions to that. So in children, that could look like, you know, some of the things that you talked about, being clingy, temper tantrums, things that are normal behaviors for kids, but after a trauma, they may start to look a little bigger. They might be a little bit different. Sometimes you'll hear that kids are more naughty, harder to parent, those kinds of things. And for youth, it may be more that they're withdrawing, that they're starting to rebel, might be starting to test some risky behaviors. So those are all normal reactions to an abnormal event. And the stats say that approximately 2/3 of children will experience at least one traumatic event before they turn 16, which is a pretty high number. So most of the time, the symptoms will last for a couple days, a couple of weeks, and with the support of family and friends, they kind of work through our bodies and we're able to discharge them, and people kind of revert back to a baseline way of being. However, that's not always the case. And so a normal response to trauma shifts over to PTSD when someone gets kind of stuck in that place, that PTSD place. The symptoms have to be in place for at least 1 month following the traumatic event before it can be considered a diagnosis of PTSD. So I'm going to briefly just kind of recap that, I guess, in a sense. So an event can happen. There's a huge stress response in your body. The body goes into kind of our kind of logic, reason, part of thinking goes offline. And we go to that reaction, that fight or flight response. So that's really normal. With the fight or flight, the neurochemicals kick in and prepares your body for what it might need to do. So, you know, whether you have to run from the scary situation or fight back or do whatever you have to do. It's a really useful physical response in your body, but it's designed that we kind of have our baseline and then we go into this intensity and then we come back down and move on. With PTSD, we move up and we get stuck here. And so the neurochemicals, it's almost like they keep bathing the brain. And in fact, if the brain sits in that state for long periods of time, it actually changes the wiring of the brain. And so some of the behaviors that I'm going to talk about, some of those signs and symptoms, people sometimes say, you know, if you can just, you just need to stop it. You just need to will yourself out of it. But it doesn't work that way. Often I would say that people have less choice in that. It's almost like it happens to them. It's a part of their experience. And so some of the changes in the brain is it changes the capacity to self-regulate, so to control and manage your feelings. I'll go into more of the responses in a minute. So in a nutshell with PTSD, the alarm system goes off in the brain, but it keeps going off even when we're no longer in danger. So you get stuck. The good news is the brain can rewire itself and get back to that baseline once you work it through. And we'll talk about that in a minute. I think it's just also really important to note that the intensity of how someone perceives their trauma is the key factor there. So it's not the trauma itself. We do know that multiple traumas, so for example, childhood physical abuse, sexual abuse, domestic violence in adults, so things that go over and over again, often have a bigger impact, but it can be a one-time incident as well. And it's really about the perception that the person has that kind of delineates how they move through it. So the DSM has specific criteria, and I'm not going to go into the whole DSM definition, but just kind of give you a nutshell. So there's certain criteria that have to be met for it to be called PTSD. An individual has to be exposed to death or threatened that they could die, or there's an actual or threatened serious injury, or an actual or threatened sexual violence. So it's enough to say to a child, if you tell anyone, I will kill you, and they can believe that they're going to die. And so they'll meet those criteria. And those things can happen in different ways in terms of the exposure. You can have direct exposure, so that you were the child themselves were abused or they were in the car accident. They can witness the trauma. So for example, a child who witnesses ongoing domestic violence in their household, so just watching it is enough to have the same impact. And they can also just learn that a relative or a close person, and so with kids it tends to be a parent or a caregiver, has experienced one of those things. And they can, it sort of passes down, and the child can pick up on that trauma and move into PTSD. One not really connected to kids, but just as part of that definition, is indirect exposure to the details of the trauma. So that would be more what we see in first responders. So people who are getting sort of that chronic over and over, they're hearing stuff, but it's not directly about them, but you can still have the same impacts. There is also, So some of the other criteria that you have to meet is the traumatic event is persistently re-experienced. And I'm going to go into what that looks like for the different age groups in a minute. So I'll just kind of tell you the criteria and then we'll kind of look at that. Another one is that there's avoidance of the trauma-related stimuli. So again, you don't want to be around anything that reminds you of that. There has to be negative thoughts or feelings that begin and worsen after the trauma. So how you feel about yourself, how you're thinking about things. And the trauma, you have related arousal in your body that gets worse afterwards. So again, we'll talk about what you talked about, that startle reflex if someone taps you. So that your body gets super, super activated and it holds on to that. There is also, in the PTSD, a modified criteria for children under the age of 6, which is wonderful because it really recognizes that these kids are at a different developmental stage, recognizes that their abstract thought, their verbal expression is not the same way. So to meet some of those criteria as an adult, you would need to be able to say, here's what's happening to me. Kids don't have that capacity, and it really depends on the age that the trauma happens, where they are in that developmental process. So for example, preschool children don't always show distress around unwanted thoughts as well. Some children might show as being quite neutral and some kind of overly bright and perky. So it can look very different in small children. And so once they added the criteria for the younger kids, they discovered, I think the last stat I read was about 8 times more diagnoses were made because the kids finally fit the criteria. Before, they didn't meet it. Mm-hmm. And if a kid couldn't talk about an event and no one had witnessed it, they wouldn't meet the criteria because it's like no one knew it happened because they couldn't tell you it happened. So mm-hmm. everything had to be reshifted. So that's really exciting that the kids can now, like, it was happening. It's not exciting that it's happening, but it's exciting that they can sort of fit into some of that criteria. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the signs and symptoms, what does that look like? What are you going to see in the kids that you're working with, in your children? The symptoms fall into a number of groups, and I'll just kind of go through what that's going to look like. So in terms of re-experiencing the trauma, that can look like a number of things. Intrusive, distressing recollections of the event. For kids, that's going to look different. It tends to be more around their play. And so they may do play reenactment. So you may see a child in the sandbox that takes the cars and keeps crashing them into each other. Sometimes that'll be really repetitive play, so it's every time they get in the sandbox, the cars are crashing into each other if they've been in an accident. Sometimes it's not. It's not quite as repetitive, and they ideally are working it through in their play, but with PTSD, again, it's like it's stuck, and so instead of calming down when they're doing the play, it can actually be more activating for them. Mm-hmm. Frightening repetitive dreams. Again, with little kids, you may not know the content of their dreams. So someone who's older can say, oh my God, I just had a nightmare. I'm working with a youth who was in a fire. And so she can talk about these nightmares where she smells the smoke and what's happening. Mm-hmm. And but for a child, they might just wake up really, really scared or fearful. So you, part of this work is helping parents learn how to be really in tune with what these signals look like, because it's so much more complicated in the younger kids. Feelings of intense distress when they're reminded of the trauma. So sight, smell, sound, touch. So again, that touch on the shoulder can be a very innocent, friendly thing, but for someone else it might echo what had happened to them. And so the body reacts as if they're in the moment of the trauma. So the fact that, you know, we're sitting right here now is irrelevant because your body thinks it's back there. So there's that disconnect. I had a youth who had been sexually assaulted, and she was walking through the mall a year later, and tons of people in the mall, really safe place for her to be, and someone walked by with the same cologne on as her assailant, and she, in her terms, I lost it. I ran to the bathroom, I was crying, I was all of those symptoms. Again, she knew she was there in the mall, he wasn't there, but her body felt like that was him, and she was back in that unsafe life or death situation. You also have physical reactions. So, you know, you talked about kind of the panic attacks. Mm-hmm. So that can be the pounding heart, rapid breathing, nausea, muscle tension, sweating, crying, all of those things. So again, you may see signs of that in a child. They may not be able to say, I'm having a panic attack. Your teenagers are better to do that. So it's watching those signs and symptoms and trying to put it into a context. And flashbacks, which is more for your teens and your older people. So again, sort of having those memories of as if they're back in it. Another sort of class of symptoms is avoiding the trauma-related stimuli. So not wanting to be near anything that reminds you of that. I worked with a child who was viciously attacked by a dog at the playground. And mom thought, okay, we got to get back to the playground. We want to, you know, get back on the bike, kind of a thinking. And every time she'd take the child down the street to the playground, the child became very fearful, temper tantrums, acting out. And it was about that, the idea of going back to that scary place was too overwhelming. And again, brought up the feelings of the trauma. Mm-hmm. Another area of symptoms is around emotional numbness and avoidance. So it can be about an inability to remember important aspects of the trauma. In kids, it's often about mixing up the order of events. This is part of why people who've experienced trauma make, in the justice system, really bad witnesses, because they can't say, here's what happened, and here's what happened, and here's what happened. And often people don't believe them, because, well, if it happened, you'd know what happened to you. But again, when you've got all of the chemical reaction happening in your body and the signs of trauma, it impacts the body's capacity to store memory, and so you don't have it in the same way. Other examples of emotional numbness, loss of interest in activities. So for kids, they may not want to play like they used to play. People may spend more time alone, and again, in the younger ones, that may be more about being socially withdrawn. Sometimes it's just a reduction in positive emotions. So your really happy, perky child is suddenly kind of neutral or dull. So they may not be able to verbalize it. They may not go to that extreme, but they might just go flat. For teens, there might be that emotional detachment. People often talk about feeling numb, and especially having negative thoughts and moods. So you might see fear, guilt, sadness, shame. And those are really heightened for survivors of sexual abuse. It tends to really impact self-esteem, the shame, the guilt, those are super heightened. And as well for other trauma, because there's a sense of maybe I could have done something if I'd only been more aware, if I'd only, right? So there's a lot of guilt around that. And the last kind of class of symptoms is around increased arousal or activation. So your body is turned on, again, fight or flight, things are kicked in and you're stuck there. So that may be difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, difficulty concentrating. So your teenager who was an A student is suddenly getting C's in school. They're not tracking, again, the way the brain's impacted, you can't track and follow things in the same way. Feeling really jumpy or easily startled. So we talk about the startle reflex. So you're walking down the street and, you know, somebody bangs a car door shut and anyone else just kind of, you know, jumps and looks. But the person with PTSD can really go through the roof and again react as if they're in that moment. So that can trigger the hyperventilation, the panic attack signs, all of those things we've talked about. Other increased arousal things you might see is irritability or angry outbursts. And for the diagnosis for the kids, your ones under six, they now talk about extreme temper tantrums. Now, again, kids have temper tantrums, and I would say most kids have an extreme temper tantrum once in a while, but these are things that get up over the norm and happen more often, more frequently. And then one of the others is around hypervigilance. So that constantly looking over your shoulder, constantly trying to check. With children, that's more around their sense that I missed something and I should have been able to figure it out. So if I'm on the ball and watching for everything, I'm going to catch the next trauma before it happens. So super, super aware of their surroundings. So they can't track some of the basic things, and yet they're like micro in tune to what's going on around them. Is the door locked? Am I safe? Who's around me? That kind of stuff, trying to prevent it from happening again. And then in adolescence, in terms of increased arousal and activation, one of the things you might see is more risky behaviors. So using substances, promiscuous sexual activity, those kinds of things. Other signs, just some general ones, that can indicate that a child or adolescent is struggling with trauma. They might start to develop new fears. So a child is suddenly afraid of, they might develop separation anxiety. They might be afraid to go over to their friend's house. So things that they didn't have issues with before. They may become more clingy or dependent. They might regress in their skills. So a child who was toilet training is now suddenly having more accidents.
Thank you.
They might return to thumb sucking or talking baby talk. And so often a parent, right, we want our kids to get back to where they were, and so we're trying to, you know, you need to stop that, when in fact what they're needing is more reassurance. So for parents, it's really hard to see this stuff in your kids. Again, self-harming behaviors, suicidal thoughts are things you might see, particularly in your older kids. Generalized misbehavior, attention seeking, poor school performance, relationship problems. So again, that's going to look different at different ages and stages, but they may start to have issues with their peers. They may not want to engage. They may be more hesitant around parents. So lots of relationship things that can play out. The other one that was mentioned, unexplained aches and pains, digestive problems, tummy aches, headaches. So again, those can be symptoms that let you know something's going on. Using alcohol and drugs to feel better. And for teens particularly, they are much more likely to show impulsive and aggressive behaviors, more so than children or adults. So teens tend to act out more. Again, if you have a teen that internalizes, doesn't mean it's not PTSD. You're watching for changes, but these are things that tend to happen. So what can parents do to support healing? Lots. Again, if they misunderstand the behavior as being naughty or difficult and try to change it or punish, that's not useful. So instead, what we're wanting to do is support, get educated, learn about PTSD, learn about the signs and symptoms, learn about the treatment. So a lot of the work is working with parents just to help them understand so that they can approach their child in the right way, in a more supportive way when things are happening. Reassuring the child. obviously, I mean, that goes back to attachment stuff, right? Being able to connect, to say it's okay, I'm here with you. Creating opportunities to talk to the child. Again, with kids, they tend to assume the worst case scenario, and so sometimes talking about it can actually help alleviate fears. It's a balance, though, of forcing someone to talk about something that they're not ready to talk about. So really trying to, you know, opening and creating opportunities, but trusting your child's lead. Giving special attention, particularly to younger kids, and especially around bedtime for younger kids, they need a little extra support than they did before. And so you have to be able to move in and create special time. Creating family activities, trying to have some sense of normalcy, if you can do that. Keeping family roles clear, so not expecting too much, not taking on too making them take on too much responsibility, but in the same breath, not hovering too much and babying and, you know, oh, you can't function. So you want to encourage them. So for things like, no, I'm afraid to go back to school, you want to be talking about that, encouraging them to get back to normal activity as soon as possible, but being mindful and supportive that that's hard and that's scary. So it's that balance piece. I think with parents, sometimes we as a parent tend to go to the extremes, right? Like we worry, we want to protect our kids, or we panic that they're never going to move out of it, and so we try to push them through it, and neither extreme is a helpful response. I think it's also really important to recognize that grieving is a part of the process. Whether it's just grieving the loss of safety that happened for a time being, grieving what happened to them, so you can expect a grieving response similar to as if there is a death in the family. People go through the same kind of process. So again, being mindful of that. And so for a parent or caregiver, that's around supporting, helping, normalizing, creating opportunities to process that. And I think it's really important to note that the parent's own mental health is going to have a huge impact on their capacity to be there for their child. And particularly challenging if the parent also went through the trauma, because it's really hard to do your own trauma work and be there for your child. And so acknowledging that with the parents you're working with, helping them to get their own supports, do their own therapy if they're also stuck. It's pretty hard to stay regulated when you can't do it, to try to do it for your child. So just recognizing that increases kind of the complexity of it all. So if the child, after all that support and all the things that you're working with the parents to do, is still having problems after 4 weeks, you may want to consider encouraging them to get professional help. And there's a number of sort of best practices treatment outcomes. For the younger kids, we talk about play therapy. And so play therapy is a safe way that kids can work through a trauma, work through any situation in their language, the language of play. And so the therapist is working with them using different modalities, play, art, those kinds of things to help them process the traumatic event. With your older kids, so again, thinking of their cognitive capacity to talk and to understand things, cognitive behavioral therapy that's trauma-focused can be useful. And there's certainly a lot of literature around it. So that can involve learning to change the thoughts and the beliefs around the trauma, helping them to learn how to relax in the trauma and to kind of calm themselves and regain those self-regulation skills. I do put a caution out, however, there are therapists out there that really believe that if you talk about the trauma, that's how you work it through. And if you talk about the trauma without having the grounding and safety skills in place, you can really re-traumatize people. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of people come to me and they're like, well, I went to counseling and they did this, and they literally got more activated. Again, puts them back into the trauma. If you do not have the skills to do the grounding work, at the same time, you can re-traumatize. So part of the work is educating parents and families about how to talk to therapists, what to ask for, making sure it feels like a good fit, making sure it's someone who's trained in trauma work. Not everybody is. Other types of therapy that are some of my favorites that are really work on the body and how the body holds trauma are somatic experiencing therapy and sensory motor therapy. And so that's really focusing on those grounding techniques and looking how your body holds the trauma, how it sits in the nervous system, and learning techniques to kind of self-regulate that and titrate it so that you can think about the trauma and then learn how to calm it in your body. And people start to learn that they have some control over this. It doesn't just happen to them and the body gets hijacked, that you can actually start to manage things. Other techniques that can be useful are EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Again, there's no one thing that's right for everybody. EMDR can use series of eye movements. It can also be through tapping. It can be through sound. So there's different ways to do it. And it can be really useful to help process trauma through. Initially, that was used around Vietnam War vets. But there's great ways to do EMDR with kids and kind of storytelling. So parents can sort of write a story about the trauma. You can put a small child in your lap and the parent can read the story and the therapist can do the work with the child. So for some people it's really helpful, for others not so much. And typically this stuff's like a jigsaw puzzle. It's not like there's a whole puzzle, it's a piece and a piece and a piece. And when you put those pieces together, supportive environment, the right kind of counseling, the right kind of grounding skills, you get the whole puzzle. And then just to mention some of the other treatments, especially for children who might show highly sexualized behaviors, there's other treatments that you can seek out for them, extreme behavior problems, and then addiction stuff around drugs and alcohol if those are necessary. And that's it.
Thanks so much, Victoria.
Now we have some time to open up to questions. Before we go to the room, I do want to ask if telehealth and Slave Lake, if you have any questions, you can go ahead and unmute yourself. Do you have a question for Victoria?
No, thanks.
Okay. That was an easy question. Next, we'll just go to the phone. If anyone on the phone has a question, you feel free to unmute yourself and you can ask Victoria, who's still with us.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. So I have a question about a young lady that I know, and she's having some serious anxiety not leaving the house. And her mom's looking for some support around, so I spoke with her the other night. I've worked with trauma. I've worked with crisis centers and things like that. So this is a neighbor whose daughter, she was worried about her daughter and came to me and asked. And the daughter feels that her situation is more just she has nausea, so she can't leave the house because of nausea. And the mother's worried. And I'm just wondering what are some things that the mother can do to support without encouraging, re-traumatizing her.
So there's a number of things. I guess for the first thing though that comes to mind for me is more questions around, is this anxiety, because people have anxiety or get anxiety disorders, is it anxiety because of a trauma? And so it can be one of many symptoms around the PTSD. Sorry, there was something else you said that I lost, but so it would depend on so first I would want to know a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment for anxiety is going to look a little bit different. So if it's anxiety with PTSD, I'm going to want to be actually, depending on the age of the child, doing more counseling, like suggesting that they connect with a therapist and do some work that way. If it's just anxiety, then there's more supportive things. There's the Taming Worry Dragons program, which is an excellent program around managing anxiety in young kids. So it depends on sort of the base of the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know what that is, in fact. So we're still trying to discover what's going on for her. But
yeah.
The other question would be around, so she's 18. She's not a young woman. So that's the other reason why I was curious around that.
If someone's choosing not to tell, so you can ask someone why they're so upset, but often we don't even know. Sometimes I talk about it that it's like a body memory. So you may not have a memory that you can consciously say this is what happened, but the body remembers. Your body doesn't forget. And so often people don't know why they're acting a certain way. So if it's, I guess my first thinking with an 18-year-old that's experiencing something like that is I would want to make sure there's lots of supports at home, checking in if something had happened that they're open to talking about, and then probably looking at counseling more with a therapist they can start to go through and tease out. If not what happened and that, you can still work on grounding skills. I mean, anyone can benefit from some of those ways to self-regulate, so that might be an area to start.
All right, thank you very much, Victoria.
And I don't know if, I mean, I see other therapists in the room, if other people have other thoughts or ideas on that.
What just jumped into my mind was www.anxietybc.com.
Mm.
Yeah. And mindcheck.ca is another great website for youth to just kind of check in and see, because it sounds like her anxiety is interfering with what she wants to do. And because I have a concurrent background, then I'm always like, what about substance use? As you know, sometimes substance use can make anxiety worse, or I don't know. I think I agree with Victoria is to ask more questions.
Good resources.
Any other questions from the phone?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
There's two people going at once, so we'll go one at a time.
Go ahead. So I just wondered, like, you talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, like an acute action, but what about, like, if a child has experienced these traumatic events since, like, 3 years old, 3.5, and other events similar to deaths in the family and that kind of thing throughout their childhood and adolescence, and now they're, you know, 14, and would you still say they suffer with post-traumatic stress disorder, or now it's sort of turned into an anxiety disorder?
The thing with PTSD is symptoms can come on very gradually, they can come on really quickly, they can come and go, and they can also show up years later. So someone who has been traumatized may be managing okay with life events, and then they hit an age or stage where something happens that can either remind them of it, or they're somehow forced to face it in a different way, or they're not in a secure place. And so the symptoms can absolutely come up years later, and it would still meet the criteria of PTSD, assuming all those other check boxes are in place.
Mm-hmm. Right, so living with PTSD then develops into something like an anxiety disorder, is that right?
I would say an anxiety disorder is an umbrella term for the different different anxiety disorders that fall under it, which PTSD would fall under the umbrella term of an anxiety disorder, along with generalized anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, panic disorder, social anxiety disorder.
If you have PTSD, you can have anxiety, but having anxiety doesn't mean you have PTSD.
Right, okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi there. I have a question. I'm working with a young man. I'm an intern, a counseling intern, working with a child who is 8, who is presenting with anxiety. And my challenge is I'm working with an anxiety that's very real for him. He had his mother suffered a heart event and was revived in front of him and so on when he was 3. And so, yeah, big event for PTSD to develop there. But working with him now is like, you know, the typical things, you know, around reassuring kids and you know, so on. It doesn't work because he still lives in this fear. His mom has a heart condition and, you know, has medical procedures and has surgery upcoming, and we just don't know what her outcome is going to be in the future. And so, you know, I'm obviously trying to create, you know, a place of safety and so on for him to be in that room and to talk about things, and we're doing play therapy, but I'm just curious if you have any tips or advice and, yeah.
You bring up a really good point. It's much harder to move through trauma when you are constantly kind of being re-exposed to a traumatizing situation. So children who may still be living with an abuser or have access from an abuser, it makes it so much more complicated. And so for this little guy, you know, if he's constantly living with the fear that something could happen to mom. So it's almost like he gets re-traumatized all the time. I think it's much more complex. You know, with older kids, you can bring in more psychoed to help them understand how it all works. And I think you can do a little bit of that with a child who's 8. They're starting to get to that place where just understanding how they feel in their body and what impacts it, helping them kind of get the pieces. But it's a tough one.
I think one of the challenges that we're facing right now is he wants to know everything that's going on. And mom's getting counsel from elsewhere saying, you know, you'll know it's good to, you know, share information with him, but he wants to be like a little adult in the room, and he wants to go to appointments, and he wants to know every date, every appointment, what's happening, you know, all of that kind of stuff, where he's becoming quite obsessed with it. And if he knows mom's going to an appointment, then he really has a difficult time functioning that day.
And so a piece of that is finding the balance between what's helpful for a child and what's not. So some information is probably, they know what's going on. They are so intuitive and they feel it. So giving some information, but really not giving a lot of information, because there's that point where it's too much for his little system to handle and he gets overwhelmed. But I wouldn't not say anything, because they're just too perceptive, and then you're going to have more issues in terms of the relationship and the sense that the parent's lying and all of that.
Yeah, okay, good, we're on the same page then. Yeah, so I don't know, like, it is a challenge, it's difficult. I feel a great deal for him in living in that, you know, uncertainty.
One other thing that can be really useful is if there's other supportive caregivers that can be involved. So what's the relationship like with dad, grandparents, aunts and uncles? Don't just look at your nuclear family, and it, you know, and I love to ask kids the question, who do you wish was in your family? Because they may say, oh, well, so-and-so, you know, my friend's mother is, so there may be other people and supports that you can bring in that can be helpful, supportive, encouraging, nurturing people in this little guy's life. If everything's around mom, that's going to feel more scary. It's not going to take away the fear around mom, but it can help to kind of spread it out a bit.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I am just going to go to questions in the room, because we do have a lot of people here today. So thank you for questions from the phone. If we have time at the end, I'll come back to you.
The conference is in lecture mode.
So anyone in the room have a question for Victoria?
I would have one question for you. This is really interesting. What is one of the challenges in diagnosing PTSD? Like, I know so many people have been given a number of different diagnoses along their path of healing before somebody said, oh, look at this collection of trauma. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially taking things and then saying, oh, PTSD, and running with that, and then the healing all of a sudden is, or the results of the healing are more visible. Because I know it's a whole long journey, but I know that it's not always the first diagnosis.
So I don't diagnose PTSD, I work with it, but I think really some of the challenges, again, because it can come on years later, months later, so people don't often make the connection. You know, you fall and break your arm and then you're in the cast. It's really quick and it's immediate, whereas PTSD, there can be those gaps. The other thing is, again, it goes back to the perception. So you can have someone that had a experience, you know, witnessed a one-time event that you just, I may go, well, that's not that big a deal, but if they perceive it as being life-threatening, and so it's really hard to know sometimes how people interpret that stuff. So part of that is, I think it's just about being mindful of the collection of symptoms and what that can look like. So you kind of keep that in your framework. It's sort of always in the back of my mind, and when I see some of the things we talked about, so if a parent's coming in because their child's having multiple temper tantrums, PTSD is not the first place I go to. But it's you know, it's always in my backdrop and on my radar. And then starting to ask more questions about other things and kind of fleshing out your assessment. Yeah. Does that answer that?
Well, you answered it right away by being like, well, you're not the person who would diagnose, and then maybe a little bit more of, yes.
It's also a term that's thrown around a lot. Like if people have experienced a trauma, it's like, oh, they have PTSD. And again, there are those set criteria that technically you have to meet. But I think it's fair to say, I mean, the work, I have to be honest, is fairly similar. Someone's experienced a trauma and they're having a hard time with it. What I do is going to look very similar whether you have all the check boxes or just some of them. It's not that different.
I was just wondering quickly, because I know you're working a lot with the parents, and how do you handle, I guess, parental guilt and shame about having this occur to their child? Like, do you find that's a barrier for them working with their child through PTSD ever, and how do you deal with that?
Absolutely, it can be. So I really speak to how parents try to care for their kids. I mean, parents... I guess with the exception of the very rare few, I mean, always have your kid's best intention at heart. And so I really want to speak to what they are doing. There's always something that parents are doing that's helpful. And so highlighting that, kind of amplifying it, helping to encourage some more ideas, education, but really supporting what they've already done. Because so much of the caring and the reassurance is intuitive, right? So they know it. Where it becomes more challenging then is when they're really angry at the behaviors and they don't like it. Sometimes that's because of their own trauma. Again, we often see intergenerational trauma, which impacts the parent's capacity to be there for their child. So then it gets more complex and I'll start to ask questions that actually take them back to what's happening for you, what does this remind you of? And often that'll open up that whole other piece. And then I'm, you know, either sending parents off to someone else or working with them around it. But really focusing on a strength-based approach and then weaving in the other stuff. And I also find, you know, they're coming to you for a reason. I mean, the fact that you know, it's so great that you recognize something was happening and you wanted to get help for your child. That's a starting point right there.
I just have a question. What would you recommend, like, if a youth is going through all this stuff like anxiety, depression, PTSD, and their parents and like family isn't like zero support at all, but they do have like counselors and doctors who they work with. What else would you suggest? Because like,
I never give up on family. Sometimes if they're not ready now, they might be ready later. So I always try to keep that hope that there's room to work with the bigger system. But if, you know, there's certainly families that aren't in a place where they're capable of engaging in that. And so then I work with what I've got. I'd be working with the youth, you know, exactly what you're talking about, doing the counseling. It depends what that looks like, and it depends on the age of the youth and their capacity to understand the parent's behavior. But I think it's exactly what you talked about. I would be doing counseling with them individually. And again, are there other people in that extended family that you might be able to weave into the process? And also, if it doesn't work with one therapist, encourage people to try it again. I mean, I've heard people say, no, I went to counseling, it didn't work. And I really think the number one variable is the fit. In my first session, at the end of the first session, I always say to people, you know, how was today? Do I feel like a good fit? Because it doesn't matter how knowledgeable I am. It's, I call it the fit factor. Like there's people we meet that we click with and there's people that we just don't. It is such a personal journey and you're in such a vulnerable place with counseling that you need to find someone that you really connect with. So it may not be the right person or they may not be doing the right approach. Again, I would be asking questions of, you know, what's the therapist's approach? How are they doing this? Asking the youth, what do they feel like they need? Because again, people are, they know what they want. And so helping tease that out and maybe helping them try it with someone else. Just because it doesn't work, you know, with me, it might not mean that it doesn't work with somebody else.
Okay. I have two questions. The first one is, I have a little boy that is going to be coming to live with us. It's three little boys. He's five, and he's quite severe FAS. Mm-hmm. So they've just been apprehended from mom, and there has been abuse throughout his life. my question, because of his FAS, he has troubles with his speech and the cognitive and stuff. What kind of therapy would you try with him?
Well, five, I mean, definitely play therapy.
Yeah.
It's going to look different because of the speech and because of the cognitive capacities. I'm not an expert around FAS and the processing. So I would definitely be looking for someone that has a lot of experience around that. And there's some amazing people out there. Brenda McCreight is connected with, does a lot of workshops for the ministry and is unbelievable. McCreight, I think is her last name. I can find it and pass it on to you.
That would be awesome.
So I would definitely be wanting someone that has a specialty around FAS and an understanding around trauma, because it's going to be loaded in that.
And then my next question is, I work with youth, and my young girl that I work with, she has been diagnosed with complex PTSD, and I'm confused. What is the difference between the complex PTSD and the PTSD? Because everything that I heard today is everything that she has, and so...
It's around the exposure, so you're simple versus you're complex. So simple is a one-time event, so I witnessed a car accident, or... I was sexually assaulted, whereas a complex is with an ongoing, so a child who has witnesses abuse for 12 years, a child who was sexually abused, so multiple.
Okay.
And so typically complex leads to more to PTSD than the simple stuff, but again, it goes back to perception.
Right.
And supports, right? Like, if you're in a really strong place and you have lots of supports, I can go through a horrific trauma and it may not impact me. Whereas if I'm, you know, it's kind of like when you're hungry and tired and the straw that breaks the camel's back versus on a day where you're, you know, you've got the world by the tail and that happens, it doesn't bother you. So the same idea. So yeah, it depends on how resourced someone is.
Thank you.
I work with a lot of youth who, have experienced trauma, and something that I kind of struggle with as a counselor is like, when do they have enough skills, like grounding and stuff, to tell their story, and when don't they? And I've had youth tell me different things, like, oh, the reason that I'm still struggling is because no one will listen to my story. But then it puts me in a position where I'm like, well, I don't want to like
open this can of worms.
Think you're, you know, so it's like, you know, that kind of wanting to create safety, but like respect autonomy and like balancing that. So I think like something I wonder is like, can someone just continue working on coping skills forever? Or
well,
like, is there a certain point where it's like, you know, like a certain point where it's like, to progress, you must at some point talk about what happened. That's just like an internal struggle I have as a counselor.
I think we can avoid something and we'll just focus on the grounding skills because that's safer. Thank you very much. So you may want to start to gently nudge. Again, we don't want to push someone through it because that's not helpful. I use a ton of attunement. So when someone's talking and they start to tell me things, I'm watching. So I'm watching if you see the glassy of the tears come up and then go away. I'm watching if the heart rate's going up. I'm watching if they're getting flushed. So they might be starting, and I might get through two sentences in an hour. So they'll start to talk about it, and I'll say, okay, well, what's happening right now? Because so often they're not even connected to it in their body. What are you noticing in your body? Where is it sitting? What does it feel like? Does it have a color? Does it have a shape? Let's take a moment. Let's just stop and put your feet on the floor, rubbing your thighs, doing some grounding. There's lots of kind of standing, sinking into your pelvis. So there's lots of kind of body techniques that you can use. Getting them back down. Okay, where are you at now? What are you noticing? Letting them move a little bit forward. Watching. And it's that titration, right? So they start to tell the story. If they can tell the story and stay regulated, not dissociated. So Gade, right? We don't want to be overactivated and we don't want to be under. So it's finding that therapeutic window. So I'm just super in tune as they're telling the story. And because often they don't have the capacity to track, that's my job. So I'm watching it. I'm noticing right now what's happening for you. What are you?
Yeah.
Oh, right. That's what that feels like. So they start to learn what it feels like in their body.
So using it as like a teaching opportunity.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. That's
yeah.
So it is just 1 o'clock now, so I will wrap up the session. If Victoria has a couple moments afterwards, she may be able to stay to answer your questions. I'm not sure, that's up to her. I really wanna thank our speakers today for their thoughts and insights on PTSD. And I also wanna thank all of our attendees in person, telehealth, on phone for coming and making this what it is. And I've recorded the audio of the pinwheel, so it'll be available in the next couple of weeks on our website as well. I hope you enjoyed today, and we're having our next pinwheel is going to be on February 28th, so next month we're having an additional special pinwheel on eating disorders and relapse, and this is going to be hosted by one of our youth ambassadors from the Kelsey Center, and it's going to be hosted by youth and for youth in honor of Eating Disorders Awareness Month. So I hope you'll be able to join us then, and a round of applause for our speakers today.